Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
On the moors, as early as this, the air no longer clung about her, impeding her movements, absorbing her energies. Now a warm breeze seemed to lift her up and bear her on. The absorption process was reversed. Her bloodstream drew impulsion from the zephyrs. Her thoughts raced from her in all directions, unproductive but joyful. She remembered the railway posters. Was this ozone? Not that she had at all disliked the big industrial city they had just left, unlike Mimi, who had loathed it. Mimi had wanted their walking tour to be each day from one youth hostel to another, but that was the one proposal Margaret had successfully resisted. Their itinerary lay in the Pennines, and Margaret had urged the case for sleeping in farmhouses and, on occasion, in conventional hotels. Mimi had suggested that the former were undependable and the latter both dreary and expensive, but suddenly her advocacy of youth hostels had filled her with shame and she had capitulated. "But hotels look down on hikers," she had added. Margaret had not, until then, regarded them as hikers.
"Screw you, hotels! Hikers are people, too!"
"Get your dirty hiker legs out of my hotel. I could see that point of view."
"Just hose them off before you let them in, that's all."
"Get a hiker hose out in the front."
"Yeah."
"Hose those legs down. Sir, I wasn't hiking. Hose them down."
That was the intro to Robert Aikman's The Trains.
I absolutely loved this one. Although all sorts of details in it remain obscure, I'd say The Trains is nowhere near as interpretive as The Stains.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly straightforward with a little action in it even.
Yep.
And like last week's Mr. Miller, it again has a bit of a Dracula feel to it. Very appropriate as we approach the Marches for Dracula's holiday season. Every year they get those Draculas out sooner, I swear.
Our reader is yet again Greg Johnson. Go to his YouTube page, watch his amazing videos, follow him on social media, and most importantly, get your butt to his Etsy page. You need the things he makes. You are incomplete without them.
I'd say even more importantly, getting to Greg's Etsy page, please ignore his many crimes.
This story, The Trains, was first published in the Fontana Book of Great Ghost Stories in 1964.
Wasn't Aikman the editor of those?
Yeah.
Slipped his own band in on the label. There's a few strange story opening moves that you can make, sort of like chess gambits.
Uh-huh.
There's the inherited mansion, the journaling from the asylum. And this one goes for the American Werewolf in London opening. Two friends hiking on the moors, and we're off.
Yep. We have these two young women, Margaret and Mimi, hiking across the Pennines. That's a range of uplands, hills, and mountains that kind of starts in Derbyshire and then goes all the way up to Scotland. It's often called the backbone of England because it goes right up the middle. Yorkshire is right in the middle of that middle, but we're not exactly sure where our characters are hiking. Mimi seems to be a bit more of a free spirit, and Margaret, from a wealthy family, is a bit more uptight.
I found the differences in their characters to be really interesting. They weren't stereotypical.
Mm.
I mean, there were some stereotypical things. Much later in the story, they make it clear that Margaret's the daughter of a lord and Mimi's the daughter of a hairdresser. Even though they both work in the civil service, I actually don't know if Margaret is from a wealthy family. They're just a titled family.
Yeah.
Margaret enjoyed the industrial city that they'd left at the beginning of the story, as was referenced in that opening, because she's a bit of a poverty tourist, it seems like.
Mm.
Mimi was really put off by that city because she feels actually connected to it. But it's odd because Margaret's a bit disadvantaged despite her social status. It says at one point that instinct may have been bred out of her. Margaret being out of touch with reality a little bit may be why she favored this travel plan of staying in farmhouses and or hotels. That's pretty romantic that people with farmhouses are just going to let you in to sleep in the comfortable hay in their barns. Like,
yeah.
It's impractical and you might not come across them and these people might be rude.
Uh-huh.
And then your other option are hotels, which, as she said, are dreary and expensive. I mean, hotels ain't cheap. If they'd done the hostels, that would have been a reliable, low-cost way to get around and a way to construct their journey, but they probably grossed Margaret out, and Mimi seemed a little embarrassed by her suggestion, so they're going to give up that more reliable path.
They're used to walking on the moors, which are up hills, usually, and at night coming down into town to stay, but on this day, they went over a moor and found no town to descend into. They are traveling by a map, and they think they might be a bit lost. In the distance, it sounds like there's a train, and if that's the case, they'll be by a track, which will help them get their bearings.
He's very much playing in the tradition of Arthur Machen here. You know, by the way, shame on us for not mentioning the great god Pan on The Stains.
Oh, right. Yes, of course.
There were some connections to be made there that we didn't make. We should have added another hour to that show. But in this story, there was this. It said they had descended to the town quite suddenly from the wildest moors, as one does in the north. Now, equally suddenly, it was as if there were no towns, but only small, long-toothed Neanderthals crouching behind rocks, waiting to tear the two of them to pieces. It's like those non-human races that are presented from in Mackin's novel of the Black Seal, which we did back on episodes 171 and 172 of HP Podcraft, or the Worms of the Earth, as Robert E. Howard called them when he ran with the ball. These little creeps out here that eventually become hobbits in Tolkien's work. But also something like Mackin's The Shining Pyramid, which we covered back in 573 on HP Podcraft. They unfold their big paper map to review it, and they weigh it down on the ground with four stones. Then when they leave, they snap up the map and leave the stones there, something that Aikman calls out three times throughout the story.
Yeah.
Here it says, the four gray stones continued to mark the corners of a now mysterious rectangle, which is there's a perfectly reasonable explanation for those stones to be there.
Yeah.
But when the next hikers come across them, they might see occult significance in it, you know, sort of like the Shining Pyramid.
Now they see a train and Mimi waves at the driver. Margaret asks, what are you doing? And Mimi explains that everyone waves to train drivers. And if you're a girl, they'll wave back. Margaret is puzzled by this and goes, only to girls do they wave back? And Mimi confirms, only to girls.
It's interesting that even though Margaret is more upper class, it's Mimi that knows all the little regimented rules of society.
Mm-hmm.
That's just something she grew up knowing about.
Yeah.
And is a little shocked that Margaret wouldn't understand that. She knows that if a boy or a man or a woman, an adult woman, waved to the driver, it might merit a sidelong glance from somebody. What's that person's problem?
Right.
Don't they know it's only girls that do that?
So they come to a building, which may be a pub or a house or both, and they're hoping that whoever owns the house will put them up for the night. As they get closer, they can see that it is an unlicensed guest house. Now, the weather is really warm. Mimi asks Margaret if she's glad that she made her wear shorts, to which Margaret says, yes. Margaret confirms that she's never worn shorts in her life. I guess this being the early 60s and England, shorts might not have been very popular with women, especially respectable women. And Mimi said she wouldn't go on this hiking trip if Margaret didn't dress like everybody else. Also, Mimi seems experienced with hiking. She talks about other girls that she's hiked with and really takes the lead. Mimi goes down to this unlicensed guest house and Margaret follows after her. Now, a woman opens the door and lets them in and takes drink orders from them. There is a middle-aged man wearing dirty tennis shoes. Mimi sits down with this guy. The room is congested with depressing cafe-style furniture, it says. The guy seems to be creeping on Mimi a bit, and according to Margaret, Mimi is the better looking of the two of them. And this guy is the only regular in this woman's cafe.
Yeah, he keeps staring at Mimi's breasts and sort of only talking to her. He's described as a North Country businessman, and he keeps bringing up that he lived in New York for 10 years, unbidden by anybody. So probably the tennis shoes are a bit of an affectation.
I thought this character was interesting because he really is creeping on them. I thought it was very astute of Aikman. That especially other men don't notice that men creep on girls like this, but girls would definitely catch this.
Yeah, yeah. The characters in here are well drawn.
Now, he tells them about this place not far away that they might be able to stay, but it's in the valley, and the valley has got a reputation. What the reputation is exactly, this guy won't say. It's called the Quiet Valley, and the locals just don't really go there. He also explains the main line for the trains goes right through it. Margaret says, one of the drivers waved to us. And then this, for the first time, the man concentrated his unpleasing stare on Margaret. He says the place they could stay is Miss Roper's place. He's never met her, but he's heard that every time a train goes by her house, she waves out the window to the drivers. Every train, he claims. And the main line runs right by the house. And he says, the joke is that they think it's a girl, but it's not. It's an old lady. Ha! With that, they say they gotta go and they're on their way.
The fact that he says that and that he finds it so funny that it's an older woman who's waving just tells you everything about his character. That guy thinks it's a young, hot girl, but it's an old one who ceased to have value.
Oh, God.
Now, Mimi had been in the room with that guy for a little bit before Margaret came in, so we don't know what else might have transpired between them. But as they're walking away, Mimi says, blasted fool. And men are usually rather horrible, replies Margaret, to what you were saying.
Yeah.
Women and the way they're treated by men is threaded throughout the story. Later on, the two encounter a character who Margaret's attracted to, but this character likes Mimi more. It's evident. There's this passage. Suddenly, looking at Mimi sprawling in her trousers and tight high-necked sweater, Margaret saw the point clearer than any book. Mimi was physically attractive. She herself, in all probability, was not. and nothing else in all life and all the world really counted. Nothing. Nothing. Being cleverer, on the whole, as she thought, kinder, being more refined, the daughter of a lord, such things were the dust beneath Mimi's chariot wheels, items in the list of life's innumerable, unwantable impedimenta. And that's just devastating, that feeling.
Yeah.
That truth that in certain situations, the externals are really all that matter at all.
Yeah.
At the same time, I know it's hard to feel bad for attractive people, mm-hmm. but you are also a prize when you're too attractive, perhaps, you know, sure. something to be kept and uninteresting if you can't be possessed. Which I think runs through this story as well.
Story of my life.
Right.
It's been hard for me. Yeah.
Go, man, this guy is so hot. And then they find out you're married and they're like, that guy.
Yeah.
I did think that it was, this story has that amazing emotional underpinning of how that can develop between friends. And it had a really realistic point of view to it. And how this person who, if you looked at the two characters on paper, you might be like, well, I don't like the Lord's daughter. She's probably stuck up and mm-hmm. silly. But you really feel for her, the situation that she's in, where none of that stuff matters.
Well, and I think ultimately, though, in the story, it's going to prove that it's Margaret is the one that actually has got the stuff that counts.
Right. So these women, they're on their way to Miss Roper's place through the Quiet Valley.
As they walk, Mimi has a very bad feeling about the Quiet Valley. They get a bit lost and the clouds roll in, and as they go downhill, it gets much colder. It starts to rain and the map gets wet and falls apart. And now it's beginning to get dark. Things are looking pretty bad for these girls.
Aikman's crafted a hell of an acting scene here. The two women are kind of rubbing each other the wrong way as they walk, disagreeing about where to go, the whole approach they took to this trip. Margaret says, well, let's try going over that hill. And Mimi lights a cigarette and says, not much else to do, being all surly. She goes, I hope we make it. Then a couple of paragraphs later, when those clouds close in upon them, quote, like a huge hood, Mimi turns and says, I hope we make it.
Uh-huh.
It's the same line, but now she means it.
Yeah.
They leave their last set of stones on the ground after that map basically disintegrates. This is the third time they've left archaic stone structures on the ground. What does it all mean?
They hear a big train roar by and know that they're going in the right direction. They get soaked through, but finally find the house after night has fallen. It's a square house, three stories high, and built in 1860. The house is very close to the railroad tracks.
It's a pitch black manor. It says, visible before them through the flying deluge was a black house. It stood about 6 fields away, no joke to reach. Why is it so black? Asked Margaret.
They knock on the door and a man answers it. They explain that they're lost and need some help and a place to stay. Another voice behind this man answers and says, of course, Beach. The man who opened the door is a servant dressed in a black suit and tie. He is a large, muscular figure with thick black hair combed back.
I mean, I'll go ahead and spoil that this is a woman dressed as a man. Aikman doesn't gender Beach as a man until later. So when I read it the second time, I noticed that.
Oh.
When Beach is showing the women their room later, it finally says he. But when this person shows up, it says a figure came to the door. And then all of the descriptions of the figure are male characteristics. Right. Mm-hmm. This is a muscular figure, a tall figure, mm-hmm. but no gender's given. And the voice is described as having a curious throat undertone, whatever that means. And the hair, it says, is cut like a musician's. You
right.
say black hair combed back. I think it's more like a Beatles bob or something since this is the 60s.
Yeah.
So a little androgynous. Hairdo, perhaps, for the time.
Now, the man of the house is Wendley Roper. He has a bit of a lordly manner and is not unattractive to Margaret. The girls introduce themselves and ask about Mrs. Roper. He explains that she was his aunt and that she has died recently. They note he's in black as well.
He's mourning. And he actually doesn't seem too surprised that they're there, it says, wandering into this black box of a house near the trains.
Which is weird.
Margaret regards the trains earlier as little capsules. None of the windows are open because of the weather, and she thinks about them as these little capsules that are imprisoning people.
Mm.
There is a lot of prison and jail imagery in the whole story.
He only has one room that they'll have to share, as the rest of the house is filled with his grandfather's collection.
Which, of course, we never find out what that is.
No.
It occupies the entire first floor. I thought, is this like the landlady where it's all taxidermied people down there? Other guests?
The implication is that it's train stuff.
There's train stuff everywhere in this house.
Yeah.
It's like modded out to be. This is the train-themed Airbnb that you really should not go stay at.
No. Now, he insists that they have dinner with him and that Beach will take them upstairs so they can change into some dry clothes.
We should take the chances life brings us, Wendley says. It's very spider slash Dracula like, I thought.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Beach shows them to their room and leaves them to get some hot water for them. Mimi says that she doesn't like Beach.
The voice puts her off. Beach also wears this big black ring on his hand that they notice. Mimi's finer instincts tell her that something's off about Beach.
Margaret points out that Roper is pretty good looking, and Mimi says that he's got a nice voice, too. Stark contrast to the creepy Beach.
Beach talks like plum jam. By the way, where are the rafters? Which I thought was it's an odd question to set up some plot, I guess. But Margaret goes, oh, they must be in this attic that's directly above our room. Who doesn't like a creepy attic above the bed? Oh. Those are the kind of amenities you look for.
Yeah. Now, while they're changing, a train rolls by and shakes the whole house loudly. And Beach comes in while Mimi is half undressed. She tries to cover herself and she yells at Beach, who says that they had knocked, but they couldn't hear because of the train. They leave the hot water. Margaret has sympathy for Beach because it was an honest mistake. The train was super loud.
And to be clear, Beach presents as male.
Yes.
Wearing a man's suit. So I think at this point, it's okay to say he.
Yeah.
This
yeah,
is okay. What the girls are assuming.
Yes. Yeah. Now, Mimi thinks she knows what's up with Beach. She thinks that Mrs. Roper was insane, and there are bars on the window of this room, and she was always waving at the trains as they went by. But Margaret thinks it's a pretty flimsy explanation for it.
Well, the whole setup of this antiquated black manor puts one in mind of Jane Eyre. It's certainly the character's reference that this is a little like novels. Mm-hmm. When Wendley said that his aunt had recently died, he said, "It was deeply distressing. I refer to the manner of her death." And then says nothing else about that. So maybe she was crazy and being kept in this room as a yellow wallpaper-esque sort of prison. Mm. Later, they find out that Miss Roper, the aunt, she was meant to be married, but the grandfather forbid his daughter to marry this guy who then went on to become a very successful senator, so foiled what could have been an awesome marriage. And so there's this Dickensian Great Expectations Miss Havisham idea as well, that maybe she's this mad old jilted spinster who was crazy in this barred up room.
Now, Mr. Roper kindly greets them when they come down for dinner and they chat at the table. He explains that his grandfather had built this house and he was one of the people that was in charge of having the rail line built. The rail took 20 years to construct and there were a lot of complications and it became something of a bugbear to his grandfather. He asks Mimi and Margaret about themselves and Mr. Roper says that he's excited that they're there. He never sees anyone, especially attractive women. This time, it's not creepy when he's saying it. They both seem to be pretty keen on him. Mm-hmm. They talk and they drink, and Mr. Roper is charming, intelligent, well-read, and a good listener. They retire to the drawing room for coffee. He explains that he's still in the railway business, but that his father died from working too hard, and his grandfather was actually killed by a train just outside this house.
Which he describes. Both the incident and the description of the incident are suspicious. You know, the trains were everything to his grandfather, even though building the line was so difficult. It was his whole life. He knew the schedule so well.
Yeah.
How would he have not known that a train was coming? But it must have been the loud rain that kept him hearing the train that killed him. Mm. But of course, this was all after he told his daughter that she couldn't marry, so nothing suspicious could have happened at all. Uh-huh. By the way, I imagine Wendley as being Vincent Price.
Oh, right. A young Vincent Price.
I'll take Vincent at any age. But yeah, probably a young. We're talking, I think they say that 30s. he's mid-40s.
Oh, he's mid-40s. I didn't realize.
I think so.
Margaret leaves them to get her sweater because she's cold. And as she goes upstairs, she realizes she's totally tired from the day and could just go to bed. But something startles the sleep right out of her. In the dark, a figure darts into one of the rooms. But this figure is obviously a woman. But there isn't supposed to be anybody else in the house. So who's she? Maybe Mr. Beach has a wife? She just kind of shrugs it off and then gets her sweater.
The mysterious crazy woman wandering the halls, again a Jane Eyre reference.
Yeah. She goes back to Mimi and Roper, and upon entering, the vibe has changed. Mimi and Roper were together on the couch, but it says here, Margaret even felt that they had vulgarly drawn further away from each other upon hearing her return.
Oh, they were getting up to something.
They were hooking up. Mimi says, hello, you've been gone a while. Margaret wants to ask about the woman that she saw upstairs, but then she kind of decides not to. Roper speaks up and says that Beach has gone to bed and that there are no other servants. So if we want anything more to eat or drink, we're going to have to do it ourselves. Mm. Margaret asks if he lives alone there with Beach, and he says quite alone.
Oh, so there's a mystery. Who was that woman?
Margaret notices that Roper doesn't seem as gentlemanly as before, more showy and silly, but she still finds him very attractive. They all go into the den, which is nice and warm and cheery. Margaret finds herself pouring the tea and being the host for Mimi and Roper.
She's slipped into the third wheel position, and this is where she has the realization about her own level of attractiveness, at least to this person.
Yeah.
She still really likes Mimi, though.
Yeah.
This had nice nuance to it, where she was both crushed by that realization, but actually not spiteful towards her friend, who then says, oh, I'm a beast, you know, are you okay? And she's like, look, she's checking in on me. She's a good person, too. Yeah. Why wouldn't he be attracted to her?
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. She's really tired from the travails of the day, so...
She excuses herself to bed, puts on her jammies in the room, and tries to sleep.
The bed is incredibly uncomfortable, and it says her mind set up a devil's dance, which would not subside for hours at the best. The bed is so narrow that the covers are tucked in so far that they overlapped beneath the occupant, it says. So she's, like, strapped into that bed by the blankets and hot... Yeah. It's more of that imprisoned jail imagery.
Another train goes by, and this one makes her think of the hospital train that her mother told her about that had wounded soldiers on it. And then she sees something. A face of a dead woman hanging above the trapdoor in the attic.
It's a nightmarish scene. Like what happens when you fall asleep, right? She's remembering what must have been a shocking thing for her as a little kid to see possibly disfigured soldiers on this train. Mm-hmm. And then it fades into this image of the dead woman's face. And suddenly she comes up with this realization. I'm seeing this hanging woman up in the attic. Old Miss Roper had hanged herself. But her dream is interrupted by somebody entering the room.
Then the door of the room opened and someone stood inside it, bearing a light. I don't think you heard me knock. As when she and Mimi had arrived, she had noticed in Roper's first words the echo of the man at the guest house. So now was another echo of Beach's cool apology for that bedroom contretemps which had so fired Mimi's wrath. To Margaret, it was as if a nightmare had reached that not uncommon point at which the sufferer, though not yet awake, not yet out of the dream, yet becomes aware that a dream it is. Then all was deep nightmare once more as Margaret recalled the shadow woman on the stairs and perceived that the same woman was now in the room with her. Margaret broke down. Still clutching her throat, she cried repeatedly in a shrill but not loud voice.
Go away! Go away! Go away! Go away!
It was, again, like her childhood. A strange woman approached and, setting down the lamp, began to shake her by the shoulders. At once, Margaret seemed to know that, whoever else she was not the dead Miss Roper, and that was all which seemed to matter. She stopped bawling like a terror-struck child, then saw that the hand still on one of her shoulders wore a dull, coal-black ring, and, looking up, that the face above her and the thick black hair were Beach's, as had been that indifferently apologetic voice. Nightmare stormed forward yet again, but this time only for an adult speck of time, for Margaret seemed now to have no doubt whatever that Beach was indeed a woman.
That is such an excellent description of sleep paralysis, that helplessness at the end of a dream where you're in the horror but can't move your body.
Yeah.
Really scary passage.
Margaret thinks that she's just fallen asleep, but Beach asks where her friend is. And she says, I don't know, I just left them downstairs. And Beach says, well, it's 3:30 now.
Margaret gets right to it. This is obviously not what was presented to us when we came in. You pretended to be the manservant. Manservant. What's the deal? Yeah. You're clearly a woman.
Beach explains that she had looked over old Miss Roper until she died. She began pretending to be a man when Wendley took over because a woman servant and a man living together would be unseemly.
Is that? I mean, I guess I just don't know culture at that time and that place, but would that be unseemly to have a female servant living with you?
I don't know what 1960s England up north was like.
It just seems like every story we read, there's some miss somebody bopping around the house, you know?
Yeah.
Margaret says, what did you do to Miss Roper? She was mad, wasn't she? Beach says, certainly not. You could be crossed in love without going mad, you know. And madhouse windows are not the only ones with bars. Margaret says, so this was simply a prison. Why? What had she done? Beach says, something to do with the railway, some secret she had from the old man and wouldn't tell Wendley. I never asked for details. I was in love. You know what that means as well as I do.
Is she having an affair with Wendley?
Yeah. So I think that Wendley, I mean, what's being revealed there is that Wendley wanted to have a secret from his grandfather, some secret thing that his grandfather knew.
Mm-hmm.
His aunt knew that secret, and he said, I want it from you. And she's like, something's wrong with Wendley. I'm not going to give it to him. So Wendley locked her up in this room. And she died there, hanging herself eventually, and was waving to the people in the train all the time, hoping they would rescue her.
Right.
Which is horrible. Margaret says, what sort of secret? Beach says, I don't know and I don't care. She wanted to keep it a secret from Wendley because she knew what he would do with it. She spent all her time trying to tell other people. Margaret wants to know, what would Wendley have done with this secret? Beach says, your friend should have some idea of that by this time. This unexpected remark was delivered in a tone of deepest venom. Uh-oh.
It's going down. So Margaret makes a run for it, and Beach grabs a tie and makes like she's going to strangle Margaret.
It's Margaret's tie that she was wearing earlier. Oh. That's like strangling Fred with his own ascot. The shame. Talking about Fred from Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, of course.
But in this story, Margaret foolishly chose the bed furthest from the door out of the room, so she's backing away right into a wall. She's cornered.
Margaret knocks into Mimi's bag, and then Mimi's knife falls out.
Flashback. Mimi's got the knife. She goes, comes from Sweden, dear. Not allowed to sell them here. This wasn't set up earlier, but I'm okay with that.
Yeah. There's no fight. It's just this. She stabs Beach in the neck.
Bam!
Boom! Pulls out a knife, stabs her once. Dead. I think she's dead. She ain't moving.
Yeah. She stabbed her with that illegal Swedish knife. But it was so, she ran into it, looked down, and then before we knew it, the murder had already happened. It was like that quick.
Yeah.
It was a great action scene.
Well, self-defense. I don't know if this is murder.
That's correct.
Now, Margaret has the calmness of mind to rummage in Beach's pockets and find her keys. She hears a scream of murder, and then somebody running up the stairs. It's Mimi. She runs in, and Margaret slams the door and locks it because the door had locks on it, but no key to do the lock. Now she's got the lock.
Yeah.
Roper runs up to the door, but he doesn't say anything.
No, he just stops outside. No banging on the door. No walking away. It's just creepy.
Oh, yeah.
Just out there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's cool that Mimi didn't need to be rescued.
You know,
it wasn't like now that Margaret knows everything, she's got to creep through the house and rescue her, which is what would typically happen so that you could see what he was doing.
Right.
But no. Off stage, she's rescued herself and run up here to extract herself from whatever the situation was.
Yeah.
So we don't know. We don't know what was happening.
And this is Margaret also proving her self-worth, hopefully to herself as well.
Yeah.
She took action and she's got a cool head and she's taking care of business. It's awesome. Now, Mimi, however, is freaking out, but she doesn't know that there's a dead person behind the bed. That's information she doesn't have.
Not yet.
Though she was not weeping, there was something unbearably desolate about her. Margaret wanted to comfort her. Mimi's experiences had been unimaginably worse than even her own. Now, Mimi is withdrawn and Margaret pulls her close and holds her. But as she does, Margaret notices stuff falling out of Mimi's pockets and they're train tickets. Her pockets are stuffed with train tickets. What the F? And one ticket she picks up and reads, it says Diamond Jubilee Special, Pudsley to Hasselwicket, third class, excursion 2S, 11D, God Save the Queen. That doesn't explain anything.
No, it just that it's an old ticket.
Yeah.
I mean, there's train stuff all over the house. I feel like he tied her down and was stuffing her pockets with tickets, or she stuffed her pockets with tickets.
Why?
While he wasn't paying attention because that helped her escape somehow. We just don't know what the heck it
it's
has
so
to
bizarre.
Do with. Other than Wendley, the clearly messed up Dracula psychopath, has some kind of train obsession going on. He's written a book about it and I don't know.
Now Margaret gets dressed and grabs their bags. Mimi seems to be in a state of shock. Mimi says there's nowhere for them to go. They're trapped. Margaret says, let's wait until sunrise. Margaret can see that Mimi is crying and holds her. The two women kissed tenderly. They came from very different environments and it was the first time that they had ever done so.
I mean, this isn't a romantic kiss, I don't think. You know, they're close now. They're prisoners now.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in this room that Miss Roper was waving from. I know that she has the keys and locked herself in, but I have no doubt that they have now been locked from the outside. I mean, they can't get out of here. Margaret considers going on her own because Mimi's like catatonic, but there's a level of closeness between them now, I guess is what I'm trying to say, that she's like, I can't leave her here to her own devices.
No.
I've got to help her. They're in a bind.
Yeah. And as they sit there quietly, Margaret thinks, I'm not some helpless old woman. And she looks over at the person that she stabbed in the neck. I'm a badass. So they sit in the dark together and don't say a word.
With the creep lurking outside, presumably.
Margaret had not for hours given a thought to the railway outside. Since that strange and dreamlike new train, nothing had passed. Then, from the very far distance, came the airy ghost of an engine whistle. Utterly impersonal at that hour and place, but, to Margaret, filled with promise. She rose and drew back the curtains from one of the queer, barred windows. Look, it's dawn. A girdle of light was slowly edging over the horizon, offering a fine day to come, unusual in such mountainous country. Margaret, aflame for action, looked quickly about the room. She herself was wearing colours unlikely to stand out in the yet faint light. Mimi's grey was hardly more helpful. There was only one thing to be done. Leaping across the room, Margaret ripped a large piece of material from the dead woman's white blouse, patched with blood. Then, as in the growing radiance, Mimi turned and for the first time saw the body. Margaret, throwing up the narrow window, waved confidently to the workman's train, which was approaching.
That's the end of the story.
See, I feel that waving's not going to do anything. Now, maybe they know that old Miss Roper's dead, but...
She's ready. She's got a knife. She's going to pop open that door and just stab that dude.
Possibly, yeah.
I think so.
I hope that's what happens.
And I like, you know, she's got a... In the beginning, she's feeling bad about herself. Mimi's more attractive. That's all that matters sometimes.
Yeah.
But they're in a situation where being attractive does not help. In fact, it kind of made the situation worse because it got that guy's attention.
Right, because Margaret wasn't the prey.
Yeah.
She wasn't the one to be owned and therefore didn't get done to her, whatever. Now, I thought that perhaps, I mean, your imagination just runs wild, especially these days where you've seen so many serial killer movies. And,
sure.
But, you know, did he throw her in some place on the grandfather's collection floor? There are all the other victims there.
Mm.
And did Mimi maybe collect all their train tickets that these people had or something as a means to hopefully identify them later or something? Maybe that's why her pockets are filled with the train tickets. I thought maybe it had something to do with other victims, since there's a hint there might be some collection about.
I think a Diamond Jubilee is the 60th anniversary of the Queen.
Uh-huh.
So that, obviously Queen Elizabeth at this time hadn't been, because we just had Queen Elizabeth II's Jubilee, Diamond Jubilee, not that long ago.
Uh-huh.
So this must be from Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. So these must be very old tickets.
Oh, yeah, yeah, maybe. That information is in there, and I'm sure it's in there for a reason to give you another piece of the puzzle, but it didn't quite make sense to me.
Yeah, well, I think that's what they're just implying that those tickets are really old. So maybe—
Are very, very old.
That's part of the collection that I just assume that's what his grandfather was into, was all the train stuff that he kept around, these old train tickets. But why they're in her pockets and why he has them or put them in her pockets, or, I don't know. It's all creepy and weird, but that's Aikman.
Well, it's just another approach to a story we've seen before. As I said at the beginning, that it had a typical weird fiction opening gambit. But then what if you're not the protagonist who gets menaced? What if you're the person on the fringes?
Mm.
You figured out the identity of the servant, but you weren't there for the actual event that happened. I don't know. Everything about this, though, the thing about Aikman is, I think that if I were listening to these podcasts and I didn't read it, I might think that it was inscrutable in some way or kind of a drag because it's so undefined.
But no.
These things are just, they crack along. Like, they're easy to read as long as they are sometimes. I always have a very good time reading them.
Yeah.
And they're very evocative. They push your mind in different places and give you a lot of feelings, even if you don't necessarily know logically what happened. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the reason I'm so attracted to them.
I agree that they're easy stories. They take you to a place. You don't worry about the things that you don't understand because it doesn't feel like you're missing something. It's a mystery. It's an intentional mystery. I don't feel like I'm a dummy and I don't get it.
No.
I feel like I'm getting cool mysteries.
There could be a very straightforward vampire story here, like I said.
Mm.
That he's a vampire who lures in travelers and Beach is kind of like a ghoul that helps him out. And maybe the grandfather and he are the same person. You know, maybe the secret that the aunt knew.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Was that this is the same person passing them off, passing themselves off generation after generation. And
could be.
Catching wary travelers in his house.
Who knows? But it's a really great story. And that's going to conclude our Aikman February.
I want to thank Greg Johnson for sticking along with us this whole time.
Oh, my God. He's such a talent. Please go to his Etsy page, go to his YouTube page, go to social media, follow him. He says great stuff. He's a treasure.
Buy his stuff, but as we'd like to say about Greg, don't ask too many questions. I'd also like to thank some patrons.
Me too.
Who've been supporting us, and I really love. And I'm going to start by thanking Brian Huggett.
I'd like to thank the O'Snarkies.
O'Snarkies. I'd like to thank Robert Taylor.
Nicholas R. Olongi. Thank you.
Magdalena Manusak. Thank you so much.
Luke Lloyd. That sounds like a secret identity of a superhero right there. Thank you.
Totally does. So does this next one. Jesse Jacoby. Thank you.
Aaron Klein. Thank you so much.
Jessica Trask, another superhero. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Rentang.
Taylor Mernani. Thank you.
John Baker. Thank you.
Bear. Thank you. Wow, a bear signed up for the show.
Wow, with those paws, how do they type? I'd also like to thank Find the Path Ventures.
And finally, thank you, Lester Young. You guys are great. We're going to be back next month with Marches for Draculas. And we will have special guests on our first episode covering the Clark Ashton Smith story, The Black Abbot of Puthuam, or something along those lines. It's lots of nonsense words in it. But we're going to have Andrew Lehman and Sean Branny of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society and the podcast Voluminous guesting with us on that first episode. Yes. So please stay tuned for that. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.